Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 30th of April. This hour of the program, President Barack Obama gave his press conference last night as he marked his 100th day in office. We'll talk about the issues that came up during that conference. There is news today that Chrysler will proceed with Chapter 11 bankruptcy. We will talk about that. We looked at numbers as we've talked about this swine flu, the number of people whose positions have yet to be filled in Health and Human Services, and it got us looking at the number of appointments. There are about 500, and this might be a light estimate, appointments to make that are subject to Senate confirmation and 3,000 positions to fill overall. Does that impede the work of government to any significant extent? The president made comments on swine flu yesterday, on waterboarding, on working with Republicans, on Iraq and Iran and Pakistan. We'll look at all of those issues this first hour of our program. Our guest is Professor Jeffrey Burnham, visiting professor of government at Georgetown University, associate director of the master's program in American government at Georgetown. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you would like to send us an email, you can do that. And that is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Professor Jeffrey Burnham, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
It is amazing when you saw the press conference last night how much this man has on his plate. There is so much, and now there's a pandemic flu.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's amazing he's able to handle so many issues at the same time. But I think he's demonstrated to the American people that he has a problem-solving mentality. Mm-hmm. And his ability to command issues that have just arisen or may not be right up on his radar screen, like state secrets or some of the other questions he was asked. It's just amazing how well-informed he is on the major issues facing the nation.
How important is it for us to see this calm demeanor in the face of so many storms? Is that important for a president?
Well, I think it's, sure. I mean, I think that's one reason why people like him. I think the main reason they like him is they trust him to address the problems facing the nation. They can perceive that he's a problem-solving man who's going to examine all the ideas that are out there and try to figure out which works best. I think that's the reason he's so popular. But his calmness is very reassuring because, of course, in the middle of a crisis, you want someone who's not going to be easily moved to emotion or anger or quick solutions that aren't going to work.
Right. What did he address last night that you thought was extremely important and perhaps new knowledge for you?
Well, I wouldn't say there was a lot of things new in last night's performance. I mean, he basically went over a number of issues that he's spoken on before. Of course, the question from the New York Times about what charmed him and troubled him was a good question. I think he certainly communicating very well with the press and with the political pundits and with the people who watch press conferences. I'm not sure how many people actually tuned in, but probably most people were impressed just by his demeanor and his ability to field questions, whatever their views might be on the specific issues that he touched upon.
Let's talk about appointments for a moment. This certainly has come up as we've looked at this health crisis we're facing right now. The figures might be low here, but evidently he has about 500 appointments that are subject to Senate confirmation and 3,000 positions to fill overall, sort of right on target when you look at other administrations. But it seems like a lot of people to me.
Well, I think that's true. I worked in the State Department for 6 years as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Environment, and so I'm familiar with the significance of political appointments in any administration. And they are very important. I mean, you can't move new policies through without the involvement of the political appointees. You can't make sure that new ideas reach the president or the secretary of state without the involvement of political appointees. There are just a lot of things that can't be done without political appointees. So, you know, while Secretary Clinton is handling all the crises that are out there that need to be addressed, I'm sure the State Department now must be kind of on sort of waiting for their appointees to show up before most of the regular bureaus can really do anything new. The problem is really critical over Treasury, of course.
Right. Is it becoming so difficult with so many background checks, and maybe a lot of people aren't being completely honest on their taxes, that it becomes not very attractive to work for the government?
Well, you know, I think that is a problem. I wish sometimes the Senate would sort of examine the competency of political appointees instead of whether they screwed up a little bit on their taxes inadvertently. I mean, what happens is when you get people in an administration who aren't really qualified for the position that they're in, and they wind up not relying on professional advice or taking steps that aren't well advised. And, you know, I think the main question the Senate ought to ask is whether this person has the background and the knowledge and the skills necessary for the job they're going to fill. And, I mean, obviously, if someone has been, you know, deliberately not paying their taxes, that's another matter. But, you know, sometimes it comes down to the fact that someone, you know, had a dispute with the District of Columbia government of over a tax, or, you know, made some minor mistake on her tax forms.
Right.
I think Senator Daschle, I don't think he deliberately didn't pay his taxes. I think he just didn't realize that he needed to pay taxes on this car that he'd been lent. And I was quite disappointed when he withdrew, because he's a man of integrity. And I think what he did, although it was rather extreme, was totally inadvertent. And I sort of wish that he'd subjected himself to the criticism that would have been made by his political opposition. I think he would have been confirmed. I mean, he's well regarded by senators of both parties.
And was a member of the body himself, so he was one
well,
of them.
Of course,
right?
He was the leader of the body.
Right.
Now Kathleen Sebelius is a wonderful choice as well, and I think Senator Daschle is involved behind the scenes on healthcare. Many of his staff people have taken key positions in the Senate and HHS, so we'll have the benefit of his knowledge. But I think that sort of sent off a cascade that just sort of slowed down the whole nomination process, appointment process, and it's not helping the administration. They need those assistant secretaries and deputy assistant secretaries in place.
Considering the fact that you were Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Environment, I'm interested in your thoughts on the environment. The president made reference last night to the fact that he doesn't know how to build one of these, but he is fully expecting an affordable plug-in hybrid car. I think he would like it from one of the big three sometime soon.
Well, I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I don't think we're going to solve the climate change problem without a lot of new technology. You should probably focus on ramping up existing technologies, because it's critical that we start taking action right now to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we don't want to, you know, put too much emphasis on a technology that may be too expensive or might not work. I like the plug-in hybrids are fine, but, you know, the kind of car that runs on gasoline as well as a battery that's already out there is pretty good, too. I there's a tendency for us to solve all of our environmental problems by saying, you know, there's this new technology that's just about to come on board, and why don't we rely on that? And that's important, but, we have to think about the short term and the medium term as well as the long term.
Right. What about the other steps the administration is taking to take on the issue of global warming? The news that we hear about what's happening on the poles is pretty alarming.
You're fading a little bit. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Can you?
Okay, good. Oh, okay, I'm just having, all right. Good.
Okay.
Well, I think they're needed steps. I think that there's a lot of good things that were done in the last administration on the environment, even though they're not recognized. But certainly in the climate change area, that was kind of put on hold because of Vice President Cheney. And I think there are a lot of instances here where the new initiatives need to be taken. I think climate change is one. Congress has already done quite a lot in their recent legislation on energy issues. So I think those are somewhat less important. But I think trying to get some sort of a structure for regulating greenhouse gases in place is the critical thing. The experience I've noted in the case of the environment is you tell American industry what it is you want them to do and they'll do it. So I think the main thing that executives in the automobile industry and the utility industry want is the standards. In other words, how much are you going to want us to reduce our CO2 emissions? Just tell us and give us a reasonable time frame, and we'll be able to come up with the solution for it. So that, of course, is a very tough thing to do in the state of the economy right now. It's difficult to impose standards on industries that are going to cost something or be the equivalent of sort of a tax on the consumer. It's a really bad time to be doing things like that. I mean, that's one issue that I think the current crisis makes extremely awkward. But you know, the history of this is you take a first step and set some standards, and you could always amend what you do later on if it's not enough.
Will those standards be forthcoming?
I'm not so sure. I think, obviously, the EPA is going to be setting standards, but that'll take a while. I think it would be a stretch for the Senate in particular, and even the House, to adopt the kinds of climate change standards that Obama and others have called for. I mean, it's not just a partisan issue, it's a regional issue. There are senators from the Midwest and the South, from industrial states, who are going to be, like Senator Spector, they're going to be listening to their constituents and trying to represent their states. And so even if no Republicans supported whatever might come out of the Environment Committee, although I think some will, it'd still be tough on quite a few Democrats. There are about 15 Democratic senators who are really not on board in terms of what's likely to come out of the Environment Committee on climate change. And so they're going to have to make some tough choices here.
Can you round out the news that we're getting this morning that Chrysler is going to proceed with Chapter 11 bankruptcy? It doesn't mean they're going under, does it?
No, I guess not. The thing I noticed was how much of a control the unions are going to have over both GM and Chrysler, that both the UAW is going to have a large share of the ownership in both cases. And so that's kind of interesting. That's rather unique. I mean, the big government and the unions it looked like to me, might be in control of both companies.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Jeffrey Burnham, visiting professor of government at Georgetown University, associate director of the master's program in American government at that university as well. We're talking about a variety of issues that came up during President Barack Obama's press conference on the occasion of his 100th day in office. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking with the founder of the Good News Network. That's coming up after 10. For you to join our conversation as we look at the president's news conference yesterday and a few other topics that are developing, the Chrysler situation that's developing, the flu pandemic, and we'll talk more about that with our guest. We now have cases in the state of Wisconsin, how government is dealing with that particular issue, and whether or not you feel confidence in government and keeping people safe and keeping this from spreading. We had talked in the last week about the number of jobs yet to be filled in the administration, the appointments that are subject to Senate confirmation that have not yet been confirmed, and the number of positions to fill overall, what your thoughts are about that, the president's thoughts on torture, which took place, waterboarding and torture last night, and this whole idea of the budget, we have yet to talk about that, and this whole idea of working together to come up with solutions to big issues, and if it's still a pretty partisan affair in Washington. Let's start our calls with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I'll be very quick. I had one question, but I have to make a comment because I was, you know, stunned by your guest's comments, and you opened the door talking about the appointments and, you know, some of the tax-related problems that some of these people have had. And my impression from what your guest said was, you know, these were minor things. How can you possibly say that when the Secretary of the Treasury, who is in charge of the IRS, cheated on his taxes? And the only reason he paid them was because he was going to be appointed. You know, he made one payment, and he knew that he was subject to a payment from prior years, and he didn't do it until, you know, until this thing came up. So, you know, I'm just stunned by that comment. Second comment I have is with regards to, you know, the budget was passed yesterday, and what's coming down the pike? And most people don't understand and don't realize that we're going to get hit with huge inflation. And the people who are going to be affected the most are the poor people, because inflation always hits the poor people first. They're also talking about cap and trade. What do most people understand for cap and trade? That means that your energy bills are going to skyrocket, and for industries also. So all the products that we're going to be buying are going to be that much more expensive. It's just a different way of taxation. I'd like your guest comments on those two points.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, I think take the cap and trade first. I agree with you. It's equivalent of a tax, and that's the reason why I think Congress has to be very cautious about this issue. It's a case where the science is telling us we have to act now, but the politics and the economics of the problem haven't been solved. So having a cap and trade system is a way of somewhat disguising the cost of to the consumer. That's why it's so popular in Congress. But yeah, I noticed, for example, over in the House that Congressman Markey and Congressman Waxman, who have the main House bill, they haven't decided whether to give these emission allowances away to people or whether to charge them for it. Well, I mean, that's the whole issue. Are you going to what's the impact of this going to be on the consumer? So I take your point that a cap and trade system would be equivalent to a tax, but I'm not sure that I do think we need to do something to limit greenhouse gas emissions. So that's why I'm saying it's a hard problem to solve given the state of the economy right now. On the Geithner thing, I wasn't thinking of Geithner when I was speaking. I was thinking of Kathleen Sebelius and an official in the District of Columbia who had really minor problems with their tax records. Geithner's was more serious, and I don't remember exactly what his problems were. I don't know if he would accept your premise. I don't think he would accept your premise that he cheated on his taxes. I think, as I recall, it was a matter that he didn't realize that he was an official of an international organization at the time, and he didn't realize he needed to pay U.S. taxes. I think it fell under the heading of a large-scale inadvertency, although he shouldn't have done it. But it raises the question. The question I was just trying to raise, I guess more as a teaser, is what about the competence of these people? I mean, we're going to be affected as taxpayers and citizens more by how well they do in office and whether they're able to do their job than what happened 5 or 10 years ago. So to me, to put the whole confirmation process on hold and to for the Senate to focus on whether you paid your taxes or not. I don't think they're really doing their job. That's important, but the more important thing is, are the people being nominated, are they qualified for the job they're doing? That's what they ought to be focusing on, I think.
And what about his point that with these kinds of policies, we're going to see a huge increase in inflation?
Oh, I'm not so, I don't, I couldn't say. I don't know what would, why does he think that's going to happen? Because the budget deficit
right.
won't be solved?
Right.
Well, I think it's a good point, but I think it's something that is going to have to be solved by entitlement reform, because the main thing that's driving the budget out of whack, other than the current crisis, but the main long-term thing is the cost of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, pensions. I mean, that's the problem, and that's not a problem that any politician of either party has really been willing to solve so far. So if we're going to avoid sort of permanent deficits that are larger than the economy can handle, we're going to have entitlement reform, as well as restraints on other forms of spending, of course.
We go to Mike from Oshkosh next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. It occurred to me as I was on hold, as the guest is talking about competency, here we are in a country where we elect actors, comedians, and pro wrestlers to, you know, the governor's office in the U.S. Senate. I don't know that competence has a great relevance for most people. It does to the guest and I and most listen to this program, but it's kind of ironic. But my question is about nuclear power. It's the one thing that the president tends to avoid. And I know he's getting pulled pretty hard from the left side of his party with Barbara Boxer and that constituency. But how do we reduce global warming? How do we affect the poles that Kathleen was addressing earlier without really transitioning from coal-based power? And we need to really switch to nuclear power. And frankly, one of the first things that the president did, if I'm not mistaken, was to take Yucca Mountain as a potential repository for our nuclear waste off the table. So now we're, I don't know how many decades behind. The guest is an energy expert. What does he think of that?
Well, I agree with your comments in general. I think nuclear power has to be part of the solution. It already is part of the solution. I mean, it's 20% of our electrical generation, and that's all clean energy. So it's already part of our solution to the climate change problem. And countries like France, which are 75% or 80% nuclear power, have an outstanding record when it comes to emitting greenhouse gas emissions. And they're using our technology. So I agree. I think the critical thing isn't so much Yucca Mountain, but the siting of new nuclear power plants. And I think there are several that are under consideration, and the way the government works or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission works is going to take a number of years for those plants to be approved. But I think that's the critical thing. I don't know all the facts of Yucca Mountain, but that's a place where you'll be burying nuclear waste a long time from now. So I think the critical thing is to get some new nuclear power plants online, and also to try to market our technology to countries like China and India, whose coal-fired or gas-fired electrical generation is going to produce major increases in greenhouse gases.
Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. Let's go to an email. When President Obama was asked whether he believed the Bush administration engaged in torture, why would he not just directly answer yes, since he does believe waterboarding is torture? It seemed like he was thinking yes, but not answering that way. Peter from Madison.
Very good question. I think he wants to avoid looking backward and examining the legal questions of whether or not Bush officials violated some law or treaty. He wants to kind of look forward. That's probably the reason he avoided the question. But I think it's pretty clear that by his definition of torture, which includes waterboarding, if that torture was authorized by his definition, and and he doesn't feel that the officials who may have engaged in it to a very limited extent ought to be prosecuted because they've been told by their superiors that it was an authorized technique. In fact, they'd been encouraged to use it. So I think that's, but I think he's trying to avoid a lengthy legal battle of over whether a lawyer who signs a memo recommending something can be prosecuted because his recommendation may be contrary to some law.
What do you think should happen on this issue? Should we just move ahead on it? Should people be prosecuted?
Well, I think what you do, in cases like this, we're so used to politicizing legal issues. I mean, I really think what you need to do in this case is to let the Justice Department examine each instance and decide for itself what whether any laws were violated. That's the way the Justice Department is supposed to work. They're not supposed to be, you know, influenced by comments of people like myself or the president. They're supposed to follow the law to the best of their ability. So I believe that is one reason just to leave the issue alone and let them examine all the cases and see what they think, whether there were any laws that were violated by these lawyers.
We go next to Jim from River Falls. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if your guest is familiar with an electric car programs that are going on in Denmark and in Israel with a partnership with a company called Better Place and Renault. They had a program on NPR on it on Friday evening where Denmark is basically going to run an electric car grid using wind power with those out in the ocean there. And Israel is actually going to power up an electric car grid using solar panels. And I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with those programs and why we aren't pushing maybe for our car companies or one of these that is going defunct to actually go whole hog into that kind of a program.
Well, I think those are excellent ideas. I'm not familiar with those particular programs, but Denmark is the place where the next climate change conference is going to occur in December, and where the European Union and China and India and the U.S. will have to agree on a path forward. So there's going to be a lot of stories coming out of Denmark. I think it's great. I mean, if you have a plug-in hybrid and the electricity that the car is running on is coal-fired electricity, I mean, how far have you gotten toward solving the greenhouse gas problem? Whereas if you're powering the car with wind or solar-generated electricity, why, that's a much better idea. You know, another better idea, it's something I worked on when I was in the Senate, and actually my senator, Senator Lugar, was the sponsor of this program, is something called cellulosic biomass, and that's ethanol made out of the non-food part of the plant. And that has no greenhouse gas effect at all because you're regrowing the plants at the same time you're burning the fuel. And that, you know, that could be, that's another technology that isn't very far away, but doesn't really involve a lot of new infrastructure. I mean, if cars could be running on cellulosic ethanol, that would be a huge step forward. And the nice thing about it is you don't have to be from a state with a lot of corn like Indiana. You could be a farmer in Senegal, and you could be making your own fuel out of the cellulosic part of any plant. And so it's a solution that could be good for the whole world. You wouldn't have to be, you know, solar and wind sometimes are more appropriate in certain locations than others, but plants can be grown anywhere.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're responding to the president's news conference last night, marking his first 100 days in office. And let's go to Mark from Lafarge next. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Hi.
What's great about Wisconsin Public Radio is we can all be experts. Some of them are guests. And I just found the statement that in discussing our power options that nuclear was, quote, clean power, to be absolutely outrageous. The byproduct pollutant from nuclear power is the most dangerous waste product that we have in this society. And to say that we don't have to worry about Yucca Mountain or some permanent logical disposal, if that's even possible, is really kind of a not very well-thought-out approach, that we only have to worry about, as your guest, eminent guest, has said, citing individual plants. I, for one, as a citizen, would be willing to start to consider nuclear power. If you take away their indemnification from liability, I don't know if your other listeners know that the nuclear power industry pays into their own insurance policy. And by law, it's the only industry in the United States, maybe the only industry in the world, that's indemnified against lawsuits. If they cause some catastrophic disaster and the losses from society eclipse their insurance fund, they're totally indemnified. So if we get rid of that and then investors still think that it's a safe place to put their money, then go for it, or at least let's have a rational discussion about it. But this is a dangerous technology, and we have to weigh the facts, not just the cheerleading here.
Well, I agree entirely with your point. I think it would be a great idea to repeal that what's called the Price-Anderson Law, so that an investor knew that investors would know they'd be fully responsible for any accident. So I take your point on that. With respect to nuclear waste, it's obviously a problem that needs to be solved and will eventually be solved. There's a lot of ways of handling nuclear waste other than burying it at Yucca Mountain, and I just don't know enough about the facts of Yucca Mountain for me to say whether or not that's a good place to put it. I think it's probably a good idea to postpone that issue until we understand the various ways of disposing of nuclear waste better. And I think as time moves on, there'll be technological improvements that may sort of avoid whatever problems there will be with Yucca Mountain. I think it would be a mistake to move forward with Yucca Mountain right now because there's no necessity to do so, and I think it would be a mistake to hold up the development of nuclear power until we've solved the nuclear waste problem, which would mean holding up the development of nuclear power, which, if you look at all the statistics, it's hard to see. If you're in favor of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the middle of the century, it's hard to see that nuclear power wouldn't be a part of that scenario. Obviously, wind and solar are going to be major parts of it as well, and some of the technologies or other guests have talked about are going to be part of it. But I just don't see solving the climate change problem without an increase in worldwide use of nuclear power.
Who gives the go-ahead for building new nuclear power plants in this country, Professor Burnham?
Sorry, what is the go-ahead?
Who would give the go-ahead on that?
Oh, it's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they follow the laws with respect on permitting, and it takes a long time for them to do that. They're following congressional laws. Another thing I might mention is I think our whole system for regulating nuclear power could be improved. We had the accident at Three Mile Island. It was not anticipated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There ought to be some kind of agency that, if there is an incident at a nuclear power plant, that brings it to public attention and forces the NRC to do something about it. So I think we need to improve our regulatory system as well as abolishing the Price-Anderson Law, which I think would make sure that investors know what risk they think they may be taking if they move forward with it.
Thank you, Mark, for your call. Habu from Madison is next. Hello, Habu.
Yes, good morning to you, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When he was asked a question, when President Obama was asked a question about foreign policy and Iraq in particular, he gave an answer, but there was one sentence or two which, in a way, tipped his hand, and I found that rather troubling. And I'll just read the quick exact quote. He said, "But there's some serious work to do on making sure how they divvy up oil revenues is ultimately settled, what the provincial powers are and boundaries, the relationship between the Kurds and the central government, etc., and also the relationship between Shia and the Kurds." Now, ostensibly, we went there for weapons of mass destruction. We, meaning the United States administration, went to Iraq for WMD, and when that wasn't found, they went there to give them democracy. But this is very troubling in that we seem to be wanting to design something, much as is the legacy in Pakistan with the giving such support to the military. And so we're kind of creating a legacy here which will ultimately come to haunt not only the people in the region, but also Iraqis themselves, and ultimately Americans. This is nation building, and this should be really to be decided by the Iraqi people and their leaders, not Americans. Thank you.
Thank you, Habu, for your call.
I didn't interpret the president as saying that he thought Americans could solve these problems. He's been, or should solve them. I think he was talking about the things that need to be done before a stable political situation can rise in Iraq. So I agree with your point, but I don't think the president meant to say that the U.S. should be solving these problems for the Iraqis. If he did, I think he misspoke, but I don't think he said that.
We'll continue our conversation with Professor Jeff Burnham. We need to talk about cooperation or lack of cooperation with Republicans, where the Republicans will be the next 100 days, how they may be refashioning themselves. We have yet to talk about Pakistan and other topics that the president addressed last night at his press conference. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Some lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. Our email address, that's open to you as well, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our guest is visiting professor of government at Georgetown University, associate director of the master's program in American government, also at Georgetown. And also, he was for 6 years with the State Department as Assistant Secretary for the Environment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Thursday, we'll talk with a woman who has put together a website, the Good News Network. It's an online newspaper which offers only positive news from around the world. So we'll talk about that, hour number two. For you to join this hour's conversation, the number 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or the email is talk@wpr.org. Pam is next from Dodgeville. Hi, Pam.
Hey, Kathleen. I wanted to ask your guest if he was aware of a nuclear program being developed in South Africa called PBMR. That has, it's based on ceramic, I guess they would be called balls. The zone of safety is 400 feet instead of the 3 miles of giant reactors. And every city could take itself off the grid and could change the dynamics of energy, period. And just wanted to know if that was on the radar screen.
Well, I think I ought to correct the record a little bit. When I was in the State Department, I was a diplomat, so I've never been in the Energy Department or been in any, claimed any sort of technical expertise. I was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Environment, which is kind of an advisory role to the Assistant Secretary, and then I was a Senior Advisor in the Africa Bureau working on African environmental issues, so I have looked a bit at the situation in South Africa. I guess I ought not to really express any opinion about a technology I really don't know anything about, but I appreciate your bringing it to our attention. I think one of the issues, I don't know about this particular technology, but one of the issues on nuclear power is siting. And should you be siting nuclear power plants close to populated areas, or should you have a large number of nuclear power plants as opposed to, you know, a center somewhere where you had a lot of them? And it's a tough issue. I mean, probably the most difficult issue with respect to nuclear power is the danger of reprocessing and nuclear proliferation. That is a problem that really is rather critical. And so this technology may be a great idea, but if you're saying that it leads to, like, every city having their own nuclear power plant, I'm not sure that's a great idea. But I don't really know.
It's not a nuclear power plant. It's something that could be in a building with a perimeter of 400 feet.
It's not nuclear?
And that's all I need to say. I recognize what you're saying about your limit of expertise in this area. Thanks for talking to us.
Wait, Pam, where do you get more information about it? Where did you find out?
If you Google South Africa, the letters PBMR.
Okay.
It's based on ceramic balls, and I believe also the waste issue is completely different. So it's not the same at all as building a nuclear power plant.
Okay. Well, I defer to your expertise. Thank you.
Thanks, Pam, for your call. Tom is next from Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got three kids and us trying to deal with college debt. And I've had experience with the Obama staff being fairly young and fairly militant regarding issues about college loans and so forth. The professor has government and academic experience. What do you think Obama will or won't be able to do down the road for the younger generation? And do you see him having to make some choices between ages and programs?
Well, yes, I'm sure he will. I don't know. What do you mean? What's the problem you confronted with respect to college debt? People who have graduated from college and need to pay off their loans?
It costs way too much. And people have debt for way too long.
Yeah, well, I mean, as a professor at Georgetown, I'm a little alarmed with the tuition that all of the major universities charge, and I'd be in favor of some kind of measure to force universities and colleges to tighten their belts. I read a study that in universities nationwide, the staff has doubled, but the number of faculty has increased by 50%. So it's obvious that, you know, the rising cost of tuition has more to do with the expansion of administrative staff than it does with faculty salaries. Speaking as a faculty member, of course, but so I do think that I don't know what solution could be done and whether the government ought to step in, but I think the rising cost of college education is a huge problem.
You'll have three in college at the same time, Tom?
Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my daughters have graduated from college, and they went to William & Mary, which is a state school, and it was very reasonable tuition. But if they'd both gone to a private college or university at the same time, I don't know what would have happened. They would have had to have financed their own education through a lot of loans and stuff.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Our number 800-486-8655. Let's talk about the role of the Republican Party for a moment. It looks as though Al Franken will probably be in the Senate. Not sure yet, but then we got Arlen Specter, that news this week. So filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. How are the Republicans fashioning themselves to be a loyal opposition to this administration? Who's the leadership? What's the role?
Well, not very well, I would say. I think the defining issue for the Republicans, and maybe for Obama as well, will be health care. Because he said he wants a health care bill signed by the end of this year. And that's a huge issue, which in the past has always been somewhat bipartisan, and whether he and the Democrats will seek and receive some cooperation from the Republicans on this issue, I think will really help to define the character of the Senate and the Republican Party. One of the reasons I left the Senate was it was so partisan, and that was like 8 years ago. Mm. And it just was. When I worked there for 20 years, and we were used to working across the aisle, and there were all these conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans, and in many ways they were kind of the middle ground that the Senate would move toward when they did something. And now, of course, it's very polarized. And so I think the test will be health care for the president as well as for the Republican Party. He can't expect to have the majority of Republicans on board, but he ought to try for a bipartisan bill, which, of course, will involve liberal Democrats giving up quite a bit of the things they like.
Right. And then there's been all this talk about he doesn't even need to worry about bipartisanship in an issue that he deems so important. He just would make it a part of reconciliation. Will he go that route?
Well, he could. I mean, the budget they passed allows the Senate to do that if after October 15th they haven't passed a bill. So I think he probably will go that route. That, of course, would make the Democrats responsible for whatever health care bill he chooses to support. So that certainly is an option. I don't think it's a good option for him. I mean, the main thing the Democrats, the liberal Democrats, want is some sort of government health plan. They want to have private health insurance folks compete with the government health care plan. And I'm not sure that that's going to, I'm certain that's not going to attract any support from Republicans and probably from a large part of the health care industry. So if he went in that direction, which I don't think he will, I don't think he'd have even the votes for to get it through the Democratic caucus. I think a lot of the things he would do to attract moderate Republicans or moderate Democrats would also attract some Republicans. So I don't think I don't quite see a scenario where he doesn't try to attract some Republicans, because they have concerns about too large of a government role that would be shared by Republicans as well. So I don't quite see why he would ram something through after October 15th. I think he'd try very hard to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom, for the call. We go to Justin from Green Bay. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The previous caller brought education back to the forefront of my mind again. As the president of our Wisconsin student government, WSG, I do a lot of work with the state and as far as getting funding for our technical colleges, but I've been a little disappointed that the education policy Obama has hasn't really addressed federal funding for our returning adults, because the increase in Pell Grants is a wonderful opportunity for our younger students, but with the challenges we have in the workforce, we're seeing our full-time enrollments at our technical colleges skyrocketing. And then when these systems are funded by approximately 65% municipal funding, they don't have the capacity to address the demands. So then they're looking to raise student tuition, and we're looking at affordability issues again.
Is that something that could be solved at the state level as opposed to the federal level?
Well, that's something that I'm working on at the state level, but I feel that if we have more federal financial aid available for the returning adults, that would definitely help take the burden off of our state systems.
I think that's a good comment. I would agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Justin. Why don't you get in touch with us? It might be a talk show involved in what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. Our email addresses, it comes to mind at the moment, is dunnk@wpr.org, Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G at WPR.org. He'd be an interesting guest, I'm sure. Your assessment, we have about 30 seconds left here, of whether or not we're on the right track.
Well, I think we are. I think the as I mentioned before, I think the president's been very bold, but I think he's also been very calm. I think he's a problem solver. He reminds me a little of President Kennedy, because President Kennedy said in a speech at Yale University that we should put ideology aside and take a look at the best ideas that are out there and see what works. And I think that's what President Obama is trying to do. I think he's looking toward the future. He's investing his political capital. He realizes there's not going to be any immediate return on it, which I think is what a president should be doing. And so I think it's very promising. But the toughest issues are, you know, health care, climate change, Pakistan,
right,
are still out there.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Jeffrey Burnham, visiting professor of government at Georgetown University. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour and for on-air production as well. News is coming up. We'll return for another Thursday Hour conversation in a moment.